The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
It says, when that was the case, they were free to righteousness. As the NIV translates glossing here, more than translating, but I think capturing certainly the thought, they were free from the control of righteousness. Free from the control of righteousness. Whereas, verse 22, what is the contrasting correlative? They are now enslaved to God. They have become slaves to God, NIV. Now, to sum up here, what these references show us is that the righteousness of God, the righteousness that is in view here, and you will note it, that it's a substantial theme. I haven't referred by any means to all the occurrences, I don't believe, but even you can see from what we've looked at, it's a substantial theme. That righteousness is associated with God. It is, in that sense, certainly not to be dissociated from the righteousness of God. It is the righteousness of God. But this righteousness here in the passage is not a forensic gift, but is seen personified as a master. It interchanges in the passage with God. To be enslaved to righteousness, is to be enslaved to God. So that the righteousness in view is a controlling and we could say further that what Paul has in view in the passage is a righteousness to which believers have been subjected and as he accents, they have been subjected once for all through union with Christ in his death and resurrection. And without getting into a false appeals to a tense and voice, I think the repeated use of the aorist tenses here, particularly the indicative usages, have such a definite once-for-all sense used in the context here. They are subjected to righteousness, so understood, once for all, So that subjection results in actual personal obedience. Because of their being subject to righteousness, they are taken up in the service of righteousness as an ongoing concern. Look again particularly at verses 16, 19, and 20. That is, to say it just once again, we've already touched on this, the righteousness in view in this passage would appear to be seen from the perspective not of justification, but of sanctification. Sanctification as both definitive and progressive. Now, with this input from Paul's usage of the theme of righteousness in chapter 6. Let's come back to 1:16 and 17. And do so on the assumption that these verses express the theme of the entire letter, the body of the letter, 1:18 through 15:13. If that is the case, we should expect that the righteousness of God comprehends sanctification as well as justification. Or looking at the way in which Paul immediately begins to develop the argument in chapter 1, bringing things out from the negative side, we should expect that the righteousness of God in view will answer to the universality of sin, not only as guilt, but as a corrupting power. And that is, as a matter of fact, what Paul emphasizes primarily in 1:18 through 30. The corrupting, the universality of sin in terms of its universal depravity, the pervasive corruption. We should expect then that as it answers to the full universality of sin, sin in all its dimensions, that the righteousness of God, as enunciating a controlling theme, has in view righteousness not only as imputed to the believer, but also as wrought in the believer. Righteousness not only as imputed to the believer, but wrought in the believer by the Holy Spirit. If that is not the case, if that is not the scope of the righteousness of God, then 1:16 and 17 is not the theme of the letter, but only of chapters 3 and 4, or perhaps 3 through 5. Remember Ritterboss's point that we touched on later. So, what we want to propose further here, or further, as so far as the usage is concerned here, the righteousness of God in 1:17, not in every occurrence, but here, the righteousness of God is both an acquitting gift and an enslaving power. Righteousness, as the righteousness of God, is in view both as a justifying gift and as a liberating power. Or we might, I think, to say it even better, the righteousness is in view. Righteousness is in view here as the gift is also controlling power. As the gift is also controlling power. Or perhaps to say it even better, what the apostle brings to light here initially and will go on to explicate is that the gift exists only as a component part. Only as it is inseparably bound up with the power that controls believers. The gift exists only as a component part is the power that controls believers.
Inseparably.
I'm not sure what I said exactly.
Inseparably.
Inseparably.
Separately.
Well, I'm going to go on to explicate, but the point is that the gift is present, the gift is given only as it is component with or bound up with, inseparable from the power that controls believers. Now, initially here, look, you see right beyond, nope, wrong overhead. Notice what Paul says right away about, or what Paul connects the righteousness of God with very clearly, and that is the dikaiosune and the dunamis theou, the power of God. The most likely connection here would appear to be this: the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, that power is exhibited in the righteousness of God revealed to faith. The righteousness of God, which is by faith. The power of God, the apostle is saying here, is more specifically his righteousness. Here the flow would appear to be that dikaiosune is the specific manifestation of dunamis. Paul is saying something here like dunamis through dikaiosune, power through righteousness, power revealed in righteousness. So the point, again, is that the gospel is God's powerful action. It is God's power operative to salvation, because it concerns God's fidelity to the promises and demand of his covenant. And that covenant fidelity, Paul is saying here, is dynamically manifested for our justification and our sanctification. Now, particularly among the commentators that we're working with here, Murray and Casaubon, not exactly sitting right next door to each other. Murray and Casaubon stress what we could, and what I've been accenting, the dynamic quality of the righteousness of God. Murray is perhaps a little less clear or emphatic. But as they do that, here we now come into a problem area. Where we're going to need for ourselves, or I'm going to need for myself with you, to be very careful the path that we negotiate. Murray limits the manifestation to justification. Murray is one that sees justification as the theme of the letter. As Murray and Casaubon were saying, stress the facet that we have been accenting here, the dynamic quality. Murray limits the manifestation to justification. Casaubon simply washes out the difference between justification and sanctification. He obliterates the difference between justification and sanctification. He says, for instance, that the justification of the ungodly, the resurrection of the dead, and creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing, that they are all equivalent, interchangeable expressions, that they all are metaphors for the one reality of the divine activity, different ways of describing the same activity: justification of the ungodly, resurrection of the dead, creation out of nothing. Maybe, Drew, let me just say a little bit more here. I think introducing these two commentators points up then the balance. This is such an important point now, the balance that interpretation has to maintain here. On the one hand, as you can see from, I'm probably getting unnecessarily, if not boringly, repetitive here, we must not allow the stress on justification as gift to eclipse the power aspect, to lose sight of the sanctification that's in view. That's one side of the picture, looking, I suppose, toward the view position represented by Murray. Don't allow the stress on justification as gift to dominate in a way that eclipses justification. On the other hand, stress on the power aspect, we must not allow that stress to eclipse justification as a gift and the distinction between justification and sanctification, as Casaubon does. Yeah, questions, comments here, yeah. Drew, okay. Walt?
From a practical pastoral point, unless I'm missing something, if someone claims that they have received the gift of justification, and he seems to have been a Christian for a long distinction period of time, but claims not to have received the power of it. In other words, a Christian still in bondage. What do we do? What do we say? How is this text addressed?
Well, I think that really opens up another angle that admittedly deserves to be included here, and I guess I'm not so much focused on, and that is the reality of what Paul also addresses in Romans, the reality of indwelling sin. So there is the tension, if you will, between no longer being slave to sin and indwelling sin. And see, I think that's just going to, there's no facile or easy pastoral rule to addressing, you know, the almost infinite combinations and permutations of that tension that are possible in the life of the believer. I don't think, you know, you have to negotiate here between pressing definitive sanctification in the direction of becoming a perfectionism, which would in effect deny indwelling sin. That has not been so much the problem in the Reformed tradition. The Reformed tradition has rather pressed indwelling sin, I think, to the point where a definitive sanctification has not become so clearly perceived. But I think the answer is always to bring, in one way or the other, however you do it, you bring the person of a pastoral concern back to Christ and who Christ is. And I think what we go on to say here may shed at least some light on your question. Yes? Yes. Yes. Right. And see, what we're trying to do is to work those without confusing. We're trying to work those together as tightly as we can and as focally as we can, as being in view in what is stated in 117. Yes, Doug.
I just want to clarify where we brought
Yes.
We originally talked about gift and justification and the activity of justification. And then we added to that the power of sanctification and being ruled by righteousness. Are all three of those senses then found in the PKR?
Yeah, well, I think if we accent the activity side, it's an activity that both gifts forensically and empowers. But it is, I think I think you want to subsume both the, whereas power communicates more the activity side of the thing, it's an activity that results both in a forensic gift and really righteous. You could also look at as the enslaving righteousness as also a gift being worked for the believer. I'm using the cat. I probably am falling into a bit of confusion in categories because I think you use the terms differently. I'm just putting matters the way in which it has been put classically. Is it a forensic gift or is it a divine activity? And I'm saying the divine activity, I think, captures the full scope of things.
Including
sanctification. Yes. Right.
Justification.
Yeah. Again, I think that maybe what I go on to say will enlighten that further. Yes.
You might mean different things all Father was saying, but he says, I speak like a man when kind of the weakness of your flesh. How does that qualify the connection that you're making?
Yeah, he uses that expression throughout his letters, and it's, to me, it's always a little bit difficult to know exactly what the force is. I think that I guess here I would understand it simply here in terms of he's not just saying I'm using a human illustration. Maybe he talks about the weakness of your flesh. I think he's wanting to say that it's in terms that you can understand, in terms of your basic human relationships. You all understand what slavery and freedom is. And yet I wouldn't want to wash out, you know, the theological significance that is just an example. But that's the best I can do on the spot. I probably need to think about that. Anybody have any further thoughts?
I just wondered if
he uses the same expression in Galatians 3 when he's talking about the covenant and elsewhere.
In Galatians 3, well, here, I wonder how this fits up with the language of sonship and adoption. Here and adoption and
circumstance
initiated while we're in the flesh, but that will outlast that.
Yeah.
And the sort of at least facile contrast between slavery and sonship.
Yeah, well, I think that would obviously be the way you want to explore it in terms connecting with Paul's other references to weakness, and just if there's the same, I guess the question would be whether it's the same. You know, Romans 8 has a profound, you know, the Spirit comes to aid us in our weakness, the Spirit of adoption. Whether the same weighted, the same weight is on weakness here. Yes, Andy. No, say that again.
What do you think of thinking of the righteousness of God in the sense of divine achievement? I think Scott does that.
Mm-hmm. You mean that would accent both aspects,
yes,
then?
Yes. Yes, it would bring it both in under one instead of saying both.
Yeah, I think that would accent more the outcome of the activity, which I think, I think what you have to account for, and we're losing sight of this maybe in our discussion, is the way in which the Old Testament background casts it into view as an activity. But see, the activity is never null. It always has an outcome. So I wouldn't want to play achievement over against activity. I would want to say it's an effective activity. So it achieves. Yes?
Paul places the parenthesis before the
what? And what do you make of this? What do you what?
Calvin is right.
Paul is wrong.
No, Paul is not wrong. Calvin has understood Paul. And I think that the Ordo Salutis that you have articulated in Book 3 of the Institutes is one that the church always has to come back to. That, and we're going to talk about that too, I guess. I shouldn't get launched too far into an excursus here. We'll really address that because I do want to bring Calvin in. But see, I think Calvin asks the question, what good, beginning of Book 3, what good is all that Christ did for us? What good is it for us if it's just out there? How do we acquire the benefits? And he comes right down where you have to come down. You acquire that by a union with Christ through the secret working of the Holy Spirit, which for him means the production of faith. And you have that union through faith, and then you have what Christ has, his justifying righteousness and his sanctifying righteousness. Union is logically and causally prior to justification and sanctification.
Paul's skipping over that one in Romans.
Yeah, no, I don't think he's so much... See, again, you've got to remember, he's not writing as a theologian, he's not writing a theological textbook. But I think that he is showing, you see, why justification can't give rise to unrighteous living, because what underlies that is a union with Christ in his death and resurrection. Otherwise, you're going to say that justification has nothing to do with fellowship with Christ or antedates union with Christ, which is the way Lutherans have argued in their Ordo Salutis. But the Reformed have not always been clear either on where to place union with Christ in an Ordo Salutis. And I think the right answer to that question is that union can't simply be subsumed in a sequence, but that the Ordo Salutis, if you will, is union with Christ by faith, and that brings distinct benefits that are not to be confused, justification and sanctification. And of course, what grounds that and keeps and is absolutely essential to understanding is what has been very important to the Reformed faith, and that is the definite character of the atonement. What has forensically secured the renovating benefits is what took place, not as a potential for all, but as a definite accomplishment for his people. See, that's how you get the concern of justification prior to sanctification, if you will. It's what takes place once for all on the cross. But then, I'm probably trying to say too much here, but you can explicate. I'm not saying Calvin has spoken the last word, and there are issues that come up that have to be addressed, like where does faith come from? So the Reformed doctrine of regeneration develops, particularly in the period beyond Dort. But the controlling perspective that you have in Book 3 of the Institutes, I think, is magisterial because it's eminently Pauline. And I'm going to try to argue here more for its Pauline character. Then you can get back at that. On that, if it's not clear. Yes? No, I see. My problem with that always is that there is a missing link. For someone to declare me righteous doesn't empower me to live. You're inevitably going to have to fill a missing link in there. No, from the actual theological reality. You don't want to make justification by faith a renovating reality. It's a forensic declarative reality. But then his step is, how can you continue to live in sin? Well, what provides the basis for no longer living in sin? You know, what is it that turns me away from sinning to turn me to living righteously for God? Now, see, I don't think that's what Murray is saying in Romans 6. See, I think Murray is arguing, I think much along the lines I am, or better, I'm arguing along the lines Murray argued, that what is in view in Romans 6, the death in view in Romans 6, is a definitive sanctification. And I think if that's not so clear in his commentary, in his article that postdates, look in his collected writings, volume 2, on article on definitive sanctification. I think he's very pointed on this issue.
And I read a principle of conduct in that aspect. I agree with the understanding of Murray's position. And then on this definitive sanctification, but he wants to divide between the indicative and imperative.
Yeah, but the question again is, what is the indicative in Romans 6? Is it a justifying indicative, or is it a sanctifying indicative? And I think the point there, as Murray argues, is that it's to be seen as sanctifying. See, definitive sanctification is an indicative, so that the imperative follows. But you see, without that without that indicative of sanctification, all of the cohortatory, all of the exhortation, is so much speaking in the wind.
Isn't justification compared to the element of the indicative of sanctification? Because if justification, indicative is divided by two categories, one is justification and one is sanctification, then what is the categorization of indicative and imperative mean about? If it's not indicative as justification and imperative as sanctification?
Because it meets two different conditions of sin. The indicative of justification meets the exigency of sin as guilt. The indicative of sanctification meets the exigency of sin as corruption and controlling power. Obviously, they are not separated, but they must be distinguished.
Is it from the Bible or from the Bible?
Well, I guess, the way the question came up, I think that if you try to bring, I think there's something missing in Paul's argument. In Romans 6, if you try to make the indicative justification, there's a missing link.
I think it's wider than Romans 7.
Okay, well, I think maybe you and I are getting to a conversation here that we should maybe carry on together, because I guess where I want to go yet will push.
In my view, Romans 7 is
Yeah, well, I think he's there dealing with the reality of the need for ongoing progressive sanctification. He's dealing with the reality of indwelling sin. But I don't think, that's in tension with the point of definitive sanctification in chapter 6. Well, we'll get plenty of chance to discuss that. We have a whole day on Romans 7 here coming up. All right, I just had said that we have to have a balance here. On the one hand, not eliminate the dimension of sanctification, or put so much stress on the gift of justification that we lose sight of the power aspect in sanctification. On the other hand, we can't then wash out the distinction either. And eight then, the key. And I will say here, the key. Not a key, but the key to the maintenance of the requisite balance here is, in one word, Christ. Christ as the righteousness of God. Now we can pick up here on a factor that we commented much earlier. And that is, it can at a first glance anyway seem strange that in a thematic statement of the gospel that we're dealing with here in 117, apparently intended to cover the main body of the letter, it can seem strange that there is no mention of Christ. What is this? A statement of the gospel without Christ? Well, we've already noted that already at the outset in verses 2 through 4, Paul has said that the gospel concerns his Son, God's Son, verse 3. And again in verses 3 and 4, in the begotten of the seed of David according to the flesh, declared to be Son of God in power through resurrection from the dead by the Spirit of holiness, a Christ in his death and resurrection, in his humiliation and exaltation, is made the center of the gospel. So that the response here to the question, as we might put it, at least for the sake of argument, why no explicit reference to Christ in our theme verse, is the implicit reference that is here. His work is so, perhaps implicitly, but powerfully present in 16 and 17, that's something so evident, so presupposed by the apostle, that no that explicit mention is not really necessary. But we don't just have to leave it here with the implicit, because Paul elsewhere leaves no doubt how an explicit reference to Christ would read or ought to read. Look, for instance, at 1 Corinthians 1:30. 1 Corinthians 1:30. As he comes to something of an immediate culmination point in his argument, and you'll be, some of you at least, will be familiar with this passage, the strong, antithetically pointed rhetoric. For of him, that is God, in the verse 29, you are in Christ, who has become to us wisdom from God. I think for clear exegesis here, you need to understand, you need to appreciate how wisdom is a central category in the argumentation that begins at 118. So that almost certainly what follows in 130 is not in sequence so much with wisdom, but breaks it down. Christ, who is the wisdom God of God, as he is that wisdom, he is specifically righteousness, sanctification, and redemption. You can notice, by the way, how Paul refers to Christ in verse 24. He is the wisdom of God as he himself is Theou Sophia. He is God's wisdom. And again, he is God's dunamis. So what I'm wanting to get at here is this, that when we see that Christ himself is really the focus in 117, as we could perhaps put it, that Christ himself is the embodiment of the righteousness of God. Christ is the living embodiment of that righteousness of God. When we grasp that, when we have some appreciation of that, then we can grasp what is the indissoluble connection between power and gift in Paul's conception of the righteousness of God. When we have the focus on Christ, we're saying, as the embodiment of the righteousness of God, then we can appreciate the indissoluble connection. I'm having a hard time saying that. The indissoluble connection of power and gift in Paul's conception. Any separation or disjunction from this angle, any separation, any disjunction between the gift aspect and the power aspect is impossible. Or as we have already put it, the gift exists only as dominating power is a component part. The gift exists only as dominating power is a component part. And you see, that is to point us to Christ. Because the gift of righteousness that Christ himself is, and we are not toning down on that in any way here, the gift of righteousness that Christ himself is, that gift is not simply to be equated with our new status, our new legal standing. That gift that Christ himself is as the righteousness of God is not simply equivalent to a forensic standing before God. For instance, 2 Corinthians 9:15, Paul speaks there of God's gift. Thanks to God for his gift, his gospel gift. The reference to the gospel is clear from verse 14. That gospel gift, which he, remember, in the memorable way of putting it, is simply indescribable. So Paul is as emphatic as you can get about Christ as indescribable gospel gift. I don't know what stronger words you could find to put it, more pointed words. But at the same time, remember in Romans 10:9, and elsewhere, to confess that Christ, to confess that Jesus as the gospel gift, the righteousness gift of God, to confess that Christ is to confess that he is Kurios. So the lordship of Christ, what we're wanting to get at here, the lordship of Christ is a distinctive content of the gift. The grand imperative, we might say, and find some other adjective than grand if you can. The grand indicative that Christ is necessarily involves an imperative. Because of the indicative that Christ is, an imperative is absolutely essential. And very quickly, and this, and you'll appreciate, this is just touching on what can be explored much more richly, deeply, and I will insist on getting this in here. Looking at things from the prophetic perspective, the angle of the Old Testament, the full dimensions that we're concerned for, gift and power together, the full dimensions of the righteousness of God revealed in Christ. See how that answers to the vision of the prophet Jeremiah. Looking particularly in Jeremiah 23, 5 and 6, and 33, 16. What the prophet foresees is the eschatological day when the Lord would raise up from David's line a righteous branch, the righteous branch. But what he adds immediately in Jeremiah 23, and it comes out again in 33, is that that righteous branch, the righteous branch is as such a king who will reign wisely. The righteous branch is a king that will reign wisely. So that all told, the prophet pushes it further, the name over this entire reality, the name over God's people will be Yahweh Tzedakenu, the Lord our righteousness. That sums it all up. The Lord our righteousness. Our righteousness is the Lord. Well, point nine draws some important conclusions here that we'll... Next week is our last time, so we'll have to... it's my last shot, I should put it that way. So we'll have to do what we can then.